Wednesday, March 21st, 1990. Dr. Sarah Little.
Come, let us sing unto the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving and make a joyful noise unto him with psalms. For the Lord is a great God, a great King above all gods. In his hand are the deep places of the earth. The strength of the hills is his also. The sea is his, and he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for the Lord is a great God, a great King above all gods. He is our God. Let us stand now as we join together in the singing of the hymn. We welcome you today to the Kendrick-Persky lectures that were begun in 1983 in honor of the parents of our faculty member, Robert Persky, and his wife, Catherine, to honor their parents, Mary Chemnitz and Ernest Johann Persky, Martha Bryant, and John Wesley Kendrick. These lectures have been given in even numbered years in the spring semester, and we have greatly benefited from them. And Bob, we dearly love what you and Catherine have done as you have made it possible to honor not only your parents, but to honor us as you have made these lectures possible. We have a number of folk who are visiting on campus these several days, those who are coming back for continuing education, and we're delighted that they are here, as also guests from the Baptist Sunday School Board in Nashville, who are joining with these persons in providing a continuing education event. And we're delighted that you are here. Our lecturer this year is Dr. Sarah Little, who recently retired as a Robert and Lucy Reynolds Kreitz Professor of Christian Education at Union Theological Seminary in Virginia. She occupied that position for a number of years. Currently, she is visiting professor at the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley. I picked her up at the airport last night. She still is not sure which time zone she's in, but she's working on it, and we're delighted that she is here. Her academic background has taken her to Yale, Harvard, and the Presbyterian School of Christian Education, but we Tar Heels know her best as a graduate of Queens College in Charlotte. We're delighted that she is here. A number of awards have been hers. I shall not try to read them all, but her association with the Association of Theological Schools as being a member of the executive committee for 6 years, for as a vice president for 2 years, endears her to us because her association there, also her relationship with the Religious Education Association, and has been involved with the projects recently with Dr. Persky entitled Youth Ministry and Theological Schools, and most recently with a project that she will be speaking of, Effective Church Education, which was a joint effort between various denominational publishing groups and Lilly Endowment. Her writing has come to us over the years, and we have been greatly benefited by it. The recent one, The Set One's Heart, outlined a way of recapturing Christian education in the church through a process of improving the whole teaching process. Dr. Sarah Little comes to us with many relationships, and we're delighted that she is going to be here for these 2 days. Dr. Little, we welcome. Welcome.
I thank you, Professor Clements, for that generous introduction. It's hard to recognize oneself sometimes in listening to that, but it's an evidence of the kind of hospitality I've experienced here before. Coming in last night from the airport, I was remembering a time that I was here many years ago and worked with groups of seminary, or not worked with, all of us seminary professors who were invited were here to work on our teaching. And I know that we had a great time here and that we talked about not only the beauty of this campus, but the hospitality, the gracious hospitality that we experienced here. So it's good to be back and to experience that same kind of thing again. I want to say, adding to what we just heard, that I'm honored to be here, honored particularly as a part of this lecture series, the Kendrick Persky lecture series. As I read through the purpose of the lectures, I found myself saying, yes, that's right, that's good, and I'm pleased to be here to give my evidence to support for that kind of purpose. And a second reason is that I'm honored to be here with Bob Persky. We have worked together for some 3.5 years, 3.5 to 4 years, in a seminar. 12 people from seminaries along the East Coast working on youth ministry and theological schools, trying to help each other with our teaching, trying to dig into a number of theological and educational issues. And during that process, we became good friends. We love each other, we care for one another, we support each other. And it's been good to see what's happened in that. One of the members of that seminar, Bob, I was with, I flew across the continent weekend before last too, so I really am not sure where I am sometime. But I was in a 4-day conference in Washington, one of the outgrowths of this project. And the person from Wesley Seminary there, Robin Moss, was saying to the audience that as a part of that seminar, she experienced what had been for her the greatest support in her professional growth that she had ever known in her life. And I remembered the good times that we had had together. I'm going to be mentioning Bruce Powers just a little bit later on when I say that a part of the content of what I'm saying this morning, Bruce may not remember it, but came at the suggestion of Bruce Power. So I'm going to quote him and make him take a part of the blame for what he said at that point. The topic, Equipping the Saints, Research and Prospects in Christian Education, I will try to deal with through three moves suggested in the title. One, Equipping the Saints, and two, Research, and three, Prospects, a fairly logical order from the title. The Equipping the Saints is just a very, very brief comment, and the reason I want to say that, and the reason that really is the focal point for these lectures, is that I think we need to remember why we do Christian education. I simply want to take my stand to say what I believe in, as it were, and that is that we engage in Christian education not as an academic exercise, not to accumulate facts, not to say we know a lot, but rather that we are engaged in Christian education for the purpose of equipping the saints for the work of ministry. I'm not going to do an exegesis. I'm not going to preach a sermon, but I do want just to remind you of that phrase and of my own personal conviction and commitment by reading just a few phrases from that marvelous fourth chapter of Ephesians, where Paul, you remember, has been pleading with us. As a prisoner of the Lord, he's pleading with us to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called. And then he goes on, forbearing one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And then he goes on through reminding us in our different situations of the gifts that we have been given. And then this phrase, what is the purpose of those gifts? To equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ until we all attain to the unity of the faith and to the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And you remember that phrase. That's simply my reminder of my own commitment and of the reason that we try to learn about and to do Christian education. Ministry is given to the whole people of God. Our task as Christian educators is to equip the people of God for the work of ministry. Then let's look a little bit at this question of research. This is the point at which Bruce Power suggested that it might be appropriate to share some of the findings of recent research. And I want to do that on two levels. One, more a quick look into some sociological research, and then some very, very specific findings in research relating to what constitutes effective church education, with, believe it or not, a dip into a look at Southern Baptists specifically. I'll tell you a little bit more about why that is possible. But first of all, looking at the broader field of research, the research that is helping us to become aware that we exist in a shifting situation. Things are changing. Much of the research with which we are confronted these days deals with the decline in membership and attendance. And sometimes it becomes very depressing. In fact, I sometimes feel very hopeless, especially when a lot of the blame is placed on Christian education. I do not think that's justifiable. I think Christian education or church education is both cause and victim. And that as we look at the role of education historically, we get some clues as to what is going on. Many of you will remember Lewis Sherrill's The Rise of Christian Education, in which he says that education flows out from religion and then feeds back into religion, and that the quality of the religious situation, the health, if you will, comes from an interchange and interaction of those two, the quality of religion, the health and vitality, and the quality of education. Where one is vital, the other is also. That would lead me then to look at that broader research that I've mentioned, really the historical and sociocultural research. I want to speak just a minute about what I'd call between the times, the relationship between the times and Christian education. That term you'll recognize, between the times, is the title of a book, Between the Times, edited by William Hutchison. It's one of the Harvard Educational and Historical Studies funded by the Lilly Endowment. Hutchison says this: "The phrase 'between the times' has sometimes been used, as it was among European theologians in the 1920s, to convey a sense of alienation and despair. It may denote an acute societal crisis, a crisis of authority, or an anxious waiting for the second coming. But these words can also refer, more neutrally as they do in the title of this book, to a gradual and somewhat painful adjustment from one social reality to another." And that's the way in which I'm using the phrase "between the times" also, to refer to a gradual and somewhat painful adjustment in the size and vitality of religious education, specifically in its church education form, as we participate in what sociologist Robert Wuthnow calls, and this is another book, the restructuring of American religion. I think you will see the influence of those studies all the way through the more specific comments that I'll make in just a moment. With Wuthnow and Hutchison, I see the restructuring of American religion as the chief force with which we need to contend in trying to understand what is going on. Consider the rise of cultural and theological pluralism. Consider the development of special purpose groups. Just think about them for a moment. Wuthnow mentions nearly 500 that have emerged since World War II. Some of which, he says, and I would agree, have contributed to denominational vitality. Some of which, I would say, have contributed to the possibility of education, but some of which have only added layers of administrative bureaucracy that have impeded productivity, and statistics also show have increased the cost of, quote, doing business in the church. 500 special purpose groups. Shifting the whole way we do education, the whole way we do the church's business. And then consider the lament of those, especially of so-called mainline denominations, who are told again and again that they're no longer establishment, no longer really of significant influence on American life or American culture. The restructuring of which Wuthnow speaks is gradually pushing denominations to the sidelines. But Hutchison says that the truly monumental decline of the role of religion from 1790 to 1860, the drastic restructuring that took place then, was of such proportion as to make 20th century realignments seem little more than mile long overdue adjustments. In fact, it may be the case that things never were as rosy or as establishmentarian as we had thought. There may have been less dominance and authority on the part of the churches in American culture than we thought. To quote Hutchison again, although such observations may seem belittling, listen to this, to be told that one has been self-deluded is more humiliating than to be told one is wicked. They may also, that's Hutchison's term, they may also lead to more favorable assessments. And he goes on to talk about Protestantism as working, serving groupings of churches. And that image, he says, is more effective now than the past vision of Protestantism as establishment turned out to be. Working, serving groupings of churches. So we do participate in a situation where we simply share in major cultural shifts. One observation of sociologists does leave me troubled, not just one, but one of them most troubled, but affirmative as to their analysis and more aware of educational responsibility. Sociologist Benton Johnson concludes from his analysis that we need to give special attention to Protestantism's own lost sheep. Those who have left the church, Johnson says, have not gone to the Moonies or the Zen Buddhists. Most of them are without religious affiliation. Most of them are our own lost sheep. and that points strongly to the importance of attention to education. Let's dip a bit in a bit more detail and a bit more specifically at the research that has been done by Search Institute from 1987 to 1990 and ask a bit more direct questions about the role of education in the lives of our persons and of ourselves. The study officially is entitled Effective Church Education, a National Study of Protestant Denominations, of Protestant Congregations. Bruce Powers was the Southern Baptist representative, seminary consultant to the group designing this study. I was the Presbyterian seminary consultant. And as Bruce and I have talked about that and tried to understand some of the findings, we decided that it would be appropriate for me at least to mention some of those. The findings officially are not released until this weekend, beginning on Saturday. Both Bruce and I will be going from here to St. Louis, and perhaps others who are here also. Dr. Williams of your Southern Baptist Sunday School Board is one of the key persons. He and others in the denominational offices are really the ones with power and money. Bruce and I only offered ideas from time to time. What is this study? It's the largest, so far as we know, the largest study of Protestant congregations ever undertaken in this century. I think it came about perhaps because of the great concern with education generally. And you know many of the studies that have taken place in general education. For example, the study The Nation at Risk had dramatic results. And I think the question came up, what is the situation in church education? And the Lilly Endowment worked with Search Institute and with six denominations for the funding of this particular project. Those denominations are Disciples, Lutherans, Presbyterians, United Church of Christ, Methodists, and as I said, the Southern Baptist. There were 563 congregations in those six denominations that participated. The persons answering very, very lengthy, 300 items or so questions. Young people from 13 up answered the questions, adults, a special questionnaire for Sunday school teachers, for pastors, and for coordinators or directors of Christian education. There were 11,122 people who answered those questionnaires. And if this is, as I said, the largest state to date of American Protestantism, then we're going to be looking at the findings from this study from a long time. I was not allowed to prepare handouts for this because officially the information isn't available. But I did get permission to go on and make and get the material to go on and make reference to at least some of the findings. I hope you will be pursuing this later on because I think personally that it has a great many implications for the way we do church education. It deals with four qualities or four characteristics of the relationship of education to the life of the church. First of all, with maturity of faith. I wish you could have been in on our conversations about what constitutes mature faith. And if you can listen to me at the same time you think your own thoughts, I would ask you to be thinking about what do I think mature faith is? What does it look like? What are its evidences? What indicators do I see in the lives of people about me? First one, maturity of faith. Second, growth in faith. When does growth occur? How do people become aware that they are growing? What constitutes the precipitating factors in that growth? Again, think about your own experiences in growth and faith. And then third, denominational loyalty. And fourth, congregational loyalty. And I think you can see in terms of what I've been saying about the shifting scene, the restructuring of American religion, why people would raise the question about whether people do indeed continue to be loyal, and if they are loyal, what is it that makes them continue to be loyal? The maturity of faith concept is defined in this way: the degree to which congregations, members, and leaders exhibit a vibrant, life-transforming faith marked by both a deep personal relationship to a loving God and a consistent devotion to serving others. That is a definition on which people have worked. What do we mean by faith maturity? Think of just one thing that term means to you. And then let me read. I wish we could pause and talk about all of these. You may, if you come to the discussion session afterwards, want to raise questions about some of these. Again, Bruce and I wrote some papers to the planners of the details of what we mean by faith maturity. You'll be interested in these eight qualities. First, a person who exhibits faith maturity, first, trust in God's saving grace and believes firmly in the humanity and divinity of Jesus. Second, experiences a sense of personal well-being, security, and peace. Third, integrates faith and life, seeing work, family, social relationships, and political choices as a part of one's religious life. Fourth, seeks spiritual growth through study, reflection, prayer, and discussion with others. Fifth, seeks to be a part. Now, this is very important when you think about congregational and denominational loyalty. Seeks to be a part of a community of believers in which people give witness to their faith and support and nourish each other. Six, whole life-affirming values, including commitment to racial and gender equality, affirmation of cultural and religious diversity, and a personal sense of responsibility for the welfare of others. Seventh, advocates social and global changes to bring about greater social justice. Eighth, serves humanity consistently and compassionately through acts of love and justice. Now, you'll notice as you listen to those that there are at least two kinds of components to that list. One, what might be called evidences of vertical religion, an awareness of a relationship with God as transcendent reality. The spiritual dimensions, the emphasis on spiritual growth is that vertical dimension. And then the second dimension is the one on the horizontal dimension, in which we're aware of our relationships to each other in this room as a part of the fellowship of Christians, our relationship to the world created by God, and a sense of responsibility for it. And a part of the efforts to categorize those numerous items, let me just tuck in here parenthetically, that people were selected by scientific random sampling so that there were congregations of different sizes, different regional groupings. The persons were selected with adequate representation for ages, as a spread in the congregation, and they were random sampling. They didn't go down and have the minister pick out people who were active and good. They had many inactive people. So we have a very good, carefully selected sampling. So the comments about these eight categories of faith maturity and about the vertical and horizontal dimension does have a diverse spectrum of people. It is not a selected spectrum. The way they related the vertical and horizontal dimensions was to have categories. You could be very strong on a vertical relationship and very low on a horizontal. You could be very high on a horizontal relationship and very low on a vertical relationship. And you may, as you think about the denominations, begin doing some questioning of yourself as to which denominations rated highest one or highest the other. Of course, the mature manhood in Christ that we read about in Ephesians would be an integrated faith in which we have both the vertical and the horizontal dimensions. Now, what are some of the findings from this study? can only touch on them. And we can perhaps discuss these, some of the questions that you might have as we go to the discussion session. But I want to mention just six findings. I wish I could do more, but six that, for me at least, in my reading of the latest printout of the findings, stand out. The first one is that there is an increase in growth toward those characteristics indicated as we move from ages 13 to 70 plus. Now, for those of us who are retired and in the elderly stage, that's kind of nice to hear that there is some indication that as you grow older, you move toward integrated faith, that from the persons, the 111,000 persons filling in these questionnaires, there's a very clear indication that overall you can see that as age increases, people increase in evidence of the characteristics of mature faith. It becomes a little bit. Now, this is not automatic. There are places it goes up and down, and I want to mention some of those. Generally speaking, and I'd like to hear what you think about this, generally speaking, females rank higher all the way through. There's one exception to that. Adult males, and I can't tell your ages, you adults, but think about this. Adult males have a rather drastic drop between 30 and 39. I've seen some other sociological studies about what happens, but it's a pretty drastic drop across the board of all the denominations between the ages of 30 and 39. Now, youth, and I'm going to speak more about youth tomorrow, but a couple of things I do just want to mention today. Youth, in general, show the same higher level of females than of males, but they're much more fluctuating with youth. It goes up and down with youth much more than it does with adults. Females start higher, and this study starts with seventh grade. Females start much higher than the males in the seventh grade. In the eighth grade, females drop way down the lowest level that females hit all the way through the eighth grade. It's the only time, so far as I can see, when the males in the eighth grade are significantly higher than the females in the eighth grade. I'd like to talk to some teachers about that and what they observe about that. But after the eighth grade, the males start down and the females start up, so that females now go down in the 11th grade, males are going up. So by the time they get to the 12th grade, they're not very far apart. The females are just a little bit higher than the females in the 12th grade. But the main point, I think, is that there is a consistent move toward maturity and faith as we move toward the older ages. The second, I'm running a little risk here, but I'm going to do it anyway. What about the Southern Baptist? Ed Briggs, and some of you, since we're not far from Richmond, in the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the religion editor, somebody sent me some headlines from him, I think maybe in January, in which the big printout headlines in the Richmond Times-Dispatch was Southern Baptists rank highest in faith ratings. Well, we had gone through all of this discussion about whether we were going to allow any kind of comparison among denominations. And I had been warned so vigorously about not saying anything about the findings I already knew about that I simply called up Peter Benson, who's the head of search, and say, well, just how does it happen that Ed Briggs gets inside information and publicizes it before it's publicly released? Well, he had some ideas about that, how that happened. But that is indicative of the fact you're going to find yourselves in headlines. You're going to find a lot of articles written raising the question about the meaning of this particular finding. What came out that is perhaps, I should perhaps not say the most dramatic, but certainly a dramatic finding, is that when all of the scales are put together, Ed Briggs is right. Southern Baptists rank highest in terms of maturity of faith of all the other denominations. I think you will want to think about that, to raise some questions, to say, how does that happen? What is it in our educational program that has contributed to that? How can we preserve and build on that? It's a pretty dramatic kind of finding. And I'm mentioning just a few of the things because I think you need to sit down and rejoice in these things that are happening. First of all, let's look at the categories of that I mentioned of a vertical faith and horizontal faith, looking first at the adolescents, the young people between 13 and 18. And let me say that for all of the denominations, all across the board, there is, of course, with younger people, a higher percentage of what they call undeveloped faith. That is really not a consolidation toward either horizontal or vertical dimension, but just the ingredients, the parts that are building, I mean, the points that later will become horizontal or vertical dimensions. But there are fewer adolescents in the Southern Baptist Church with undeveloped faith than with any other denomination. The other five denominations taken together have 63% of the adolescents with what's called an undeveloped faith. That is I think, fascinating. Southern Baptists have 40%, all the other denominations 63% of undeveloped faith. When you get to the vertical faith, there's a strong vertical faith in Southern Baptist adolescents. 19% of Southern Baptist adolescents have what is called a strong vertical faith. In the other denominations taken together, they're only 7% with that strong vertical faith of adolescents. In the horizontal faith, 12% of the Southern Baptist have a horizontal faith as over against 19% of other adolescents and other denominations. Now that says that there is more, it seems to me, more of a sense of a vertical relationship than of a horizontal relationship. It's slightly higher, not significantly. There's very little difference. Well, I'm not sure about the statistical, but there's not a big difference between the 12% who show a strong horizontal faith in the Southern Baptists and the 19% of other denominations. Then when you get to an integrated faith, there's a far larger number of Southern Baptist young people who show an integrated faith than of any other of the main denominations that are studied. 30% show an integrated faith for the young people. 11% of the young people total in the other denominations show an integrated faith. Just look briefly at the adults. What is the situation with respect to adults? Again, there are fewer adults who show undeveloped faith, 23%. Than in the other denominations, they're 36%. The denomination that is nearest to Southern Baptist with undeveloped faith is the Lutheran Church with 47%. In the vertical faith, again, there is a strong sense of vertical faith, the highest of any others, 25%. Of Southern Baptist adults show a strong vertical faith. The overall percentage is 22 for the other denominations. Again, there's this distinction, and you may want to say, what does that mean? There are only 3% of the adults, and this is, for me, would be the most striking and the question that would be raised. Only 3% of Southern Baptist adults show a strong horizontal faith, a desire to become involved in the cultural dimensions and the responsibility for society and for the church. Whereas for the other five denominations, 22% show a strong horizontal faith. But when you come back to the integrated faith, the mature faith, again, Southern Baptists are high. It's 49% is related to 32% of other denominations. They have also done a summary of the Christian educators, the teachers and leaders. And let me just say, instead of enumerating those statistics, they will be available, and again, we can talk about them if we want to, but the same kinds of shapes of maturity in faith, percentages of undeveloped, of vertical and of horizontal faith show in the leaders that show in the youth and in the adults. Now, what about loyalty to denomination and to congregations? How do you, I assume that the majority of people here are Southern Baptists, though I would assume that not everyone is. But whatever your denomination think, are the people that I know loyal to their congregation and to their denomination? This also parallels what I've said earlier. And with respect to the denomination, the percentage of Southern Baptist adults who are loyal to the denomination are far higher than that of any other denomination. When you get to the oldest group of adults, and incidentally, the loyalty to the denomination and to the congregation goes up with age. Also, if you stick with it, I guess your loyalty and your sense of loyalty grows. But for those who are 60 and up, 96% of Southern Baptist adults are loyal to the denomination, whereas only 79% of other denominations are loyal. How about the congregation? This is interesting for Southern Baptists, too, that a few more people are loyal to the denomination than are loyal to the congregation. There's a 96% loyalty to the denomination and a 91% to the congregation for this oldest group of adults. So there again, the Southern Baptists distinguish themselves. Whatever's been happening has eventuated in those important statistics. There are some other important figures that come out of that. For example, you might say that with respect to young people and their involvement and their loyalty, if they expect to be active in a church when they're 30 or 40, then you might say they have very strong positive feelings toward the congregation and the denomination. That question was raised. Young people were asked whether they expected to be active in participating in congregations when they were 40. 55% of Southern Baptist youth said yes. The next highest were the Methodists, and 37% said yes. That's a pretty significant difference. It went on down. I'm not that happy about Presbyterians. It went on down as we went to other denominations, but that's a pretty significant difference between 37 and 55. Enough of that. That may be intriguing enough to you to make you want to see some of the other statistics and want to figure it out. And perhaps after the four-day conference that we'll be going to this weekend, we'll have some better sense of how we interpret those findings. Actually, it seems to me that what we need to do is to look at ourselves and at the figures as they relate to us. And I hope we don't get caught up just in the denominational comparison, which is going to be fun for a while, but we need ultimately to look at ourselves and to see what that means. The next category of findings came from a section in the report called A Need for Changes. What is it that people face as they look at education programs and say, these things need to be changed if we're going to be successful? I think there are no surprises. Let me just read down through those and see if there are any surprises to you. The top seven problems that people face, and this is all the denominations taken together. There are some differences, but not significant difference in these. The top seven, adults' busy schedules. Where did you ever hear that before? Teenagers' busy schedules. Recruitment of volunteer teachers and leaders. Parent disinterest. adult disinterest, the lack of teenage motivation, irregular attendance of all ages. That sounds pretty much like the things that at least some of us, I'm sure, have experienced. They're significant in a spatial way because the correlation figures also show that where adults are interested, you are more likely to have good congregational programs that rate high in effectiveness. Where the pastors are interested, the correlation with effectiveness is high. So these things are important, not just because they're problems, because when you explore them in a broader dimension and you see that they're dealt with positively, it does make a difference in whether church education is effective. Let's look at what people say they're interested in. Again, think for yourselves, what are people interested in if they say they're going to be dealing with something that's important? And in this order, the top, and these are for adults, and they're very near the same for most mainline and for most of the six denominations. The top seven that people say they would like to see included in their program, let me just say, this part, I think, is where we're going to have some very significant help, Sunday school boards, congregations, as we plan for the future. The top one that they want more attention to is the Bible. Developing personal relationship with Jesus. Improving my skills at showing love and concern. How to be a good spouse or parent. Applying my faith to daily living. Making more friends at church. How Christians make moral decisions. An agenda for program planning. Now, youth are a little bit different, and again, I'll say some more about other facets of this tomorrow, but just to mention this because I think it's so very interesting. Southern Baptist youth put at the very top of what they want to find from their congregations, learning to know and love Jesus Christ. That's first. Others put at the top, knowing how to make friends and be a friend. I think that's significant. Learning to know and love Jesus Christ, knowing how to make friends and be a friend. And let me just say, from my point of view, one of the instructive things to me as a Presbyterian is to say, I think I would rather have the young people would put at the top learning to know and love Jesus than learning to know and love friends. A second thing to note is the second rating for Southern Baptist is recognizing right and wrong in making decisions of others. The second one is to know and love Jesus Christ. The Bible is the eighth for the general findings of young people, and it's the third for Southern Baptist. But we do have some guidance as to what people are interested in. Now, what contributes significantly to education? And these are not statistics, but they're grouped in areas that persons have said really makes a difference to me in my own awareness of growth in faith. This is just for adults. The youth are different, and I can mention those later. These are not surprising. It's encouraging to me to see this because it says to me that some of the things that we thought were true are verified by hard data as over against soft data or hunches. One, if teachers have high faith maturity, if they are committed and give evidence of being persons of faith, if it's obvious that they give significant time to preparation, if they work on their teaching, if teachers stay with their task a while instead of rotating every two or three Sundays or every month, if those things are true, you find a correlation with congregations that rate high in effective church education. In the category of educational strategies,
we find again the kinds of things that, for me at least, confirm what I would expect. In educational strategies, when people pay high attention to sharing personal perspectives on faith, people want a chance to talk about their faith. When there's high attention to individual nature of spiritual development, when there's high attention to faith perspectives on political and social issues, and this is interesting, when there's a cross-generational coordination of themes, one that stands out is when the pastor spends significant time in adult education, the congregation is more likely to be an effective congregation. And I've already mentioned this, when adults are interested in and active in education, it correlates with effectiveness. And then I won't read the list of administration, but it just shows if you plan well and carefully, if there's a well-administered program, then again, things go better. Teachers are particularly appreciative, as shows up in this research, of administrative showing of support and nurture and help in training and in supplying the resources that they need to teach. So those factors, again, as I say, perhaps confirm what we know, but they also, some of the other factors, for example, comparing denominations, may not confirm what we know. But it's interesting to compare our hunches with what the statistics show. And then a final indication about the findings, and this is the one that some of you who know me will know I delight in. All the way through, one of the findings is on what I call the importance of cognitivity. That is to say, most of us, I suspect, go about saying if you get a congregation that's warm and friendly, that's the most important thing. It is very important. But when people say what contributes, one, to your growth in faith and your awareness of growth in faith, and two, what do statistics show about mature faith and how people correlate with that, thinking contributes more to faith maturity and denominational loyalty than warmth does. Faith contributes more, thinking, high, stimulating, digging into understanding and meeting contributes more to people's, one, awareness, faith maturity, and denominational loyalty. Now, when you talk about congregational loyalty, warmth contributes more, but faith, growth in faith, and denominational loyalty, you need to pay attention to whether or not the educational program is stimulating and helpful. Now, what can be said in summary? Negatively, I've listed some high statistics. What can be said in summary? Negatively, there is a low level of faith maturity. Many congregations are populated by adults and adolescents whose faith is not particularly well developed. If I understand all the statistics and the charts, and they're about that thick, if I understand those, speaking loosely, it could be said that of all persons, if I understand what they say, only slightly over half, speaking loosely because it does vary, of all persons in participating denominations are characterized by what might be called mature faith. Only slightly over half. And less than that show loyalty to either denomination or congregation. I think that is a sobering kind of figure. Further, when we look at the overall process statistically and whether people say they are aware within the last 2 or 3 years of growth in faith, people are not aware that they are growing in faith. As Benson said, and Peter Benson is the director, people would look elsewhere, or I would say nowhere, for help with matters pertaining to faith if there is not educational reform. There are hopeful signs, the one that I mentioned of cognitivity. The level of activity in congregations correlates with maturity and awareness of growth. That is, if people are active, they rate higher in awareness of growth and maturity in faith. The role of the pastor. And most interesting is the major summary statement of the whole research. Effective Christian education is the most powerful single influence congregations have on maturity of faith when they look at everything else. Effective church education is the most powerful single influence congregations have on maturity of faith. What about the prospects for the future? I'm not going to go into this in detail. I just want to dip tantalizingly into a very few prospects for the future. And I know you see your own prospects, but let me just mention some to contribute to your reflection and to your conversation. The first I would want to suggest is this. Let's build on what we're doing and do it better. We find confirmation for much of what we're doing. Some of you may have read the article by D. Campbell Wyckoff during the time of the 200th anniversary of the Sunday School in 1980. It was a marvelous article entitled, "The Sunday School is American as Crabgrass." And Wyckoff says, you can't kill it and it won't die. And for people who go around saying that the solution to the future is to kill the Sunday School and put in something else, I'd say no way. Nurture it. Let it live, do a better job. Don't put all of our faith in it, but know that it can be improved. A second prospect that I'd want us to capitalize on, take seriously the finding that people are interested in substantive learning. Take that. That's very, very important. It is as important for youth as for adults. Third, be on the alert for and willing to develop new institutions. Last year at our Sprunt Lectures at Union Seminary, Bob Lynn, who was vice president for the Lilly Endowment and taught at Union in New York before that, gave our Sprunt Lectures an historical reflection on education. And Bob said it's interesting to him that no new educational institutions or agencies have developed in this century. And ever since, I've been watching for doors to open and say, what is it that we ought to be developing, stimulate our creative imagination? A fourth thing I would suggest is to pick up that phrase that we heard from Wuthnow and Wade Clark Roof, and let's replace the metaphor of establishment with that of working, serving groupings of churches. Working, serving groupings of churches. And fifth, give attention to the meaning of religious pluralism. And I'm not talking about toleration. I'm not talking about the much-voiced faddism that we hear. I'm talking about ability to deal with truth claims and to come to know ourselves and who we are better in dialogue with others. And then finally, reclaim and reaffirm the importance of teaching as over against curriculum reform. I think all the things we've heard about teachers, about the influence of personal commitment and faith, and even how they teach would confirm this. I expect most of you have seen the article, the issue, the early February issue of Christian Century on theological education. And in that issue, the introduction makes reference to a statement by James Gustafson, who said that he had been analyzing all of the literature about theological education from 1955 to 85, and his conclusion was we'd given far more attention to curriculum reform than to teaching. And according to Jim, I would say, and according to Jim, we need to give more attention to teaching. And I would say the same thing is true about church education. Perhaps, as he said, the most important part of seminary is the character of teachers and the quality of their teaching. And I would want to say the same thing about church education. Let me conclude with just a statement from a posthumously published book, Faith on Earth, by Richard Niebuhr. When student and teacher are related to each other as mature beings who trust each other and keep faith with each other, they are at the same time acknowledging each other as selves who are bound to serve a cause which transcends both, bound to a host of inquirers and learners of many centuries located in many places who have all bound themselves to seek truth as well as to communicate truly. And that, as nearly as I can see, is as good a way as I know to move toward the future in these changing times. Thank you.
Let's stand. Remind you that there will be a dialogue session in Broyhill Hall immediately following our benediction. Let us pray. God of mercy, lead us to more completely examine our lives during this Lenten season, as also you enable us to see a world in pain. Help us to experience anew your love for us and for all humankind, and guide us as we seek to demonstrate your love for this world, but especially among the poor, the oppressed, the broken. And we ask this through Jesus the Christ, whom we call Savior and Lord. Amen.